All right, good afternoon, everybody. This is Bio 241. And we're going to finish up muscle today. That's chapter 12, and then move on to chapter 13, which is blood and circulation. A lot of that chapter is review for you from anatomy, so I'm not going to cover a lot of that in lecture. But if there's questions at the end of the chapter or on the web that cover anatomy, then you'll be responsible for it. So that's why I included some slides, even though I won't go over it necessarily. Like, how many chambers does a heart have?
Four.
How many valves does a heart have?
Four.
Yeah, so it's four and four. So a lot of that is just really nice, simple review. I graded the tests. I put them on Blackboard during break. Everybody did really well. Not everybody, but most people did really well. It's pretty impressive, actually. I would say probably most people did get A's. I didn't actually look at that particular statistic. So congratulations. If you were one of the hordes that got an A on the test, I don't mean to diminish your study habits or your diligence in earning that grade, because I didn't think it was that easy of a test. But anyway, congratulations. So hopefully you are learning what to study for the class, right? So if you put the time in, chances are you can do pretty well in here. All right, and then you'll be getting them back in lab. A couple labs have seen them already. And since we're talking about tests, we do have one scheduled on April 22nd. That's before the drop date. The drop date is the 25th. And I don't know if we'll be able to cover the material before the 22nd, which means then the next test will be after the drop date. I don't know if I like that very much or not. So I'm going to try and get through the material so you can have your next test a week from Wednesday. All right, so we'll see. If not, then maybe it'll be on Monday after the drop date. So we'll just have to see how that goes. Okay, so does anybody have any question on muscles so far? Before we finish up muscles, I know the semester is going to wrap up really fast, so just hang in there and we'll get through it. So any questions on muscles so far? No? Okay. So we still have to talk, I believe, about cardiac muscle and smooth muscle. You know a lot about skeletal muscle now. All right, so if you were to look at this slide right over here, what, yeah? Oh, I didn't finish up over here? Coactivation? Maybe right over here someplace? Okay. All right. So we were talking about proprioceptors. Proprioceptors are receptors that you have in tendons and in muscles and joint capsules that relay information, particularly to the cerebellum, what the tension is like in a particular muscle or tendon, and if it's appropriate. So that's the whole job of these proprioceptors, to help maintain balance so that if more tension or less tension is developed by muscle, the cerebellum can make corrections so that you don't fall over or do some kind of ungainly motion with your body. So there are two kinds of fibers in a muscle spindle. All right, there are the extrafusal fibers that are actually producing the tension, and then the intrafusal fibers, which are going to be used for measuring that tension and sending the signal back to the cerebellum. All right, so when we say coactivation, right, the alpha motor fiber will cause a skeletal muscle to contract. And if a muscle starts to stretch and it puts extra tension on these extrafusal fibers, then the intrafusal fibers have to have tension on them as well. They can't be relaxed. If they were relaxed and then you start to stretch them, then they wouldn't appreciate any of that stretching. So the slack in these intrafusal fibers has to be taken up. So when the extrafusal fibers or the normal muscle fibers contract, so do the intrafusal fibers. All right, so that when the muscle starts to stretch, these actually stretch, and that sends that stretch signal back to the cerebellum. And that is used as an error signal, which then can be corrected. The cerebellum corrects that by causing contraction of these extrafusal fibers. So that's what we mean by coactivation, right? So both the alpha and gamma motor neurons are simultaneously stimulated so that there's always some tension in the muscle spindle apparatus. All right, so why is that important? Well, for instance, you might be familiar with the knee-jerk reflex. All right, so these are the quadriceps muscles. And when you start to perform some kind of motion, the cerebellum figures out what kind of tension that kind of muscle should develop. And for instance, if this muscle is at rest and you start to stretch it by tapping the patellar ligament right here that pulls on the patella and then that pulls on the tendon of the quadriceps and that stretches this whole muscle, well, that's an inappropriate motion. And it is going to be monitored by the spindle apparatus. And since the spindle apparatus has adjusted its length because of coactivation with the extrafusal fibers right here, the muscle spindle starts to stretch. That sends a signal to the spinal cord, right? So here's the dorsal root. This is how sensory information enters the spinal root. And then that automatically stimulates an alpha motor neuron, which causes the extrafusal fibers to contract, thereby protecting this limb from motion that is unexpected. All right, so that is just what? That's just a monosynaptic reflex. These signals also go up the spinal cord to the cerebellum. Right? But reflexes, typically, when we talk about stretch reflexes, they are happening just within the spinal cord, at the level of the spinal cord. All right, so this one right here is called a Golgi tendon organ reflex. So not only do you have muscle spindles within a muscle that can measure tension, you do have Golgi tendon organs that are in basically the junction between a tendon and a muscle, and they're also embedded in the tendon. And these are real important. For instance, have you ever been lifting something that was pretty heavy, maybe like a couch or a bed or something, and of course you can't lift that by yourself. You need help doing that. So you're on one end and somebody's on the other end, or maybe a TV set that's really heavy. And then all of a sudden, who's ever helping you, it slips out of their grasp. All right, it falls out of their hand because they didn't grab it tight enough. So there you are holding up what? The whole couch by yourself. And now all that weight is on your body, which is too much weight. And so all those muscles that you're using to hold up that heavy object feel this big rush of weight on your body, and so how does your body respond to that? Does it contract even further and rip all those muscles up and pull tendons off of bones? Okay, maybe disarticulate joints? All right, it's the Golgi tendon organs that feel that big weight that's put on you. All right, and so it says what? Oh, there's way too much weight on this muscle, way too much tension. That sends a signal in that stimulates a association neuron. The association neuron is inhibitory, and that inhibits the alpha motor neuron to that muscle that is holding up that weight that is impossible for you to hold up without damaging that muscle, and it causes that muscle to relax. Okay, and then you let go of that object as well, and that protects your muscles from being damaged. So that's a typical Golgi tendon type of reflex, and that's a disynaptic reflex that requires an association neuron. So that prevents excessive muscle contraction or passive muscle stretching as a result of that. Okay, and so I think that's all I'm going to say about reflexes, except reflexes are very fast, automatic kinds of circuits that you have that do require central nervous system, but central nervous system at the level of the spinal cord. All right, and so this reflex happens even before you're even aware that your body might be moved inappropriately, or some kind of tension is damaging a muscle, right? But there's another association neuron that comes from the sensory neuron, which then sends signals to the brain for your appreciation as well. So a lot of times reflexes happen before you even know it, but of course a split second later you are aware of what's happening, okay? And probably would have made the same decision to protect yourself. Okay. All right, so let's move on to cardiac and smooth muscle. So if you see this slide right here, right, what kind of tissue are you going to recognize this as?
Cardiac.
As cardiac muscle, because you see it's striated, right? And you see that it's branched, and it has intercalated discs right here. And so because of the striations, you know it's some kind of muscle. You know it's not skeletal muscle because of the branching pattern. And these gap junctions right here basically are sodium channels, so that when one cell depolarizes in the heart, Guess what happens to that depolarization? It could move from one cell to the next, right, to the next. So, for instance, if this cell here depolarizes, this one depolarizes, and where does that stimulation go? It goes to the next cell, but it also goes, what, deeper down into the next layer of the heart. So not only does it move over the whole surface of the heart, but it moves through the whole thickness of the heart as well because of the branching pattern. So that's why myocardial cells are branched. So that depolarization not only goes from base to apex, but from the superficial part of the myocardium to the deeper parts of the myocardium as well. All right, so this is a good place where we see gap junctions. Do we see gap junctions in skeletal muscle? No. And why is that a good thing? Why is that a good thing? Yeah, because if you were to contract one skeletal muscle, okay, and if all your muscles were connected by gap junctions, what would that mean? That would mean that all your muscles in your body would contract together, right? Or at least all the muscle fibers in a muscle would contract, and you wouldn't be able to gracefully lift anything up because all your muscles would just contract with maximal force. Okay, so gap junctions allow for the spread of action potentials throughout the whole myocardium. And when I say myocardium, what do I mean? I mean the whole heart. Yeah, the whole heart muscle. So myocardium and heart we use interchangeably. All right, the heart, though, heart muscle, is not voluntary like skeletal muscle. Okay, so how is excitation-contraction coupling similar or different compared to skeletal muscle? All right, well, when we get into the next chapter, we're going to see that the heart can be spontaneously active. It can depolarize by itself. Does not necessarily need innervation to contract. It needs innervation to adjust the rhythmicity, the autorhythmicity of the heart. All right, so it can spontaneously depolarize. And when it depolarizes, that causes voltage-gated sodium channels to open. And here is a transverse tubule in a myocardial cell. And these transverse tubules have voltage-gated calcium channels, and calcium then enters the cell. Now, in cardiac muscles, we don't have a ryanodine receptor that couples directly in a mechanical way from voltage-gated channels on the T-tubule to the sarcoplasmic reticulum, right? There's this space right here. Nonetheless, in myocardial tissue, there is a sarcoplasmic reticulum that sequesters calcium, right? That's a reservoir for calcium. But when calcium enters the cell from the T-tubule, it triggers these calcium-induced calcium release channels to open up. All right, so as soon as calcium levels start to increase, these receptors or these channels open up, and that releases a large amount of calcium. All right, and that calcium then can bind to troponin, and that moves tropomyosin out of the way, just the usual kind of scheme that you've seen in skeletal muscle. So the big difference here is that there is no mechanically coupled ryanodine receptor. It's just a pure and simple calcium-induced calcium release channel. And then the heart muscle relaxes because, just like in skeletal muscle, you have a calcium ATPase pump that pumps calcium back into the sarcoplasmic reticulum. And when that happens, then cross bridges can't form between the myosin and actin, and the heart muscle relaxes as a result. Okay, so excitation-contraction coupling is pretty similar, all right, in that calcium increases within the cell because of release from the sarcoplasmic reticulum, and then calcium still binds to troponin. The other thing is that I'll ask you is, where is this troponin molecule located? Okay, where is that troponin located? What is it more closely associated with? What are the two kinds of myofilaments?
Actin
and myosin. They got the thin and the thick one. And where's that troponin located?
Actin.
It's actually on the thin one. Yeah, the actin molecule. Okay, so that is similar compared to skeletal muscle. Calcium binds or regulates activates a regulatory site or molecule on the actin molecule, not the myosin molecule. Okay, smooth muscle. Oh, here's a sign-in sheet. I forgot to bring a little model down. Maybe next time I'll remember. Smooth muscle. When we look at smooth muscle on this micrograph, right, it might be difficult to tell that that is actually muscle because what's one thing that is absent? I don't see any striations in smooth muscle. All right, I do see just a single nucleus per cell, These are kind of spiculated cells. That means they have little pointy ends. They're just long and narrow. They're not branched. They don't have striations. So since it's not striated, they really don't have sarcomeres. But nonetheless, they still do have actin and myosin filaments, right, that slide over each other that cause the muscle to shorten or to contract. So there's no sarcomeres. Some have gap junctions between them, like in the heart. So you can see there might be some similarities with heart muscle. It contains a lot more actin than myosin. Okay, and so this allows for greater stretching and contracting of smooth muscle. All right. Now, in cardiac and skeletal muscle, the actin filaments are attached to what? What part of a sarcomere? Yeah, the Z-disc, right? All right, but in smooth muscle, the actin is attached to these special proteins that are anchored within the cell membrane, the plasma membrane, and we call these dense bodies. All right, so there's no Z-discs, and because there's this network of dense bodies on the surface of the cell, there are no sarcomeres and there's no uniform striated appearance on smooth muscle. Okay, and you can also see that there's a greater density of myosin heads right in the center of a myosin molecule compared to what we saw for skeletal muscle. Okay, so the arrangement of things are quite a bit different in smooth muscle. All right, smooth muscle contraction is controlled by calcium, but in a much different kind of way compared to skeletal and cardiac muscle. Smooth muscle has very little sarcoplasmic reticulum. What did skeletal and cardiac muscle use sarcoplasmic reticulum for? As a reservoir for calcium. Okay, so there's no reservoir for calcium inside the cell. Nonetheless, calcium does play an important role in excitation-contraction coupling, but in smooth muscle, that calcium comes from an extracellular source. It comes from outside the cell, not from within inside the cell, because there's no sarcoplasmic reticulum. Also, there's no troponin. There's no tropomyosin in smooth muscle actin. All right, so calcium is still the signal that causes sliding of myofilaments, but not necessarily in the same way. All right, so calcium enters the cell through voltage-gated calcium channels in the plasma membrane to let in extracellular calcium. That's where the major calcium signal comes from outside the cell. Now, calcium here, instead of binding to troponin, binds to calmodulin. We've seen that regulatory molecule before, calmodulin, and I call that like a cousin molecule to troponin, right? All right, and then this calcium-calmodulin complex activates an enzyme called myosin light chain kinase. And you can tell me what that enzyme does. What does that enzyme do? It adds a phosphate to something, all right, and it adds it to myosin. All right, and the part of myosin, somebody took a bunch of myosin and broke it down into its little component parts, and the one little component part that gets phosphorylated is a small portion of it, which is what they call the light one, not as opposed to the heavy part of that molecule. This is the small light part. So it doesn't have to do with darkness or light or color. It's just the weight of this particular part on the myosin molecule. All right? And when myosin light chain kinase phosphorylates, that activates myosin. All right? So that's kind of interesting, because what molecule is being used as a controlling element for sliding of myofilaments in smooth muscle? Okay, calcium is used because it's activating myosin, but what molecule gets activated in skeletal and cardiac muscle? Where is troponin located? It's on the actin molecule. So there's a pretty big difference between smooth muscle and cardiac and skeletal, right? So the controlling element flips from actin to myosin in smooth muscle. Right, and when it's phosphorylated, then myosin forms cross bridges with actin and myosin ATPase. Oh, I tell you what, I have this statement right here. Because myosin is still going to hydrolyze ATP and use it as an energy source for the forming of cross bridges, but myosin ATPase in smooth muscle is very slow acting compared to cardiac and skeletal muscle. So if it's slow acting, what could you maybe think about or tell me what the rate of contraction is going to be between smooth muscle and skeletal muscle. If smooth muscle hydrolyzes ATP much more slowly, it's going to contract much more slowly as a result of that. Okay, so that's really the big reason why smooth muscle contracts much more slowly. And then relaxation occurs when calcium concentration decreases, all right, when calcium is pumped back out of the cell. All right, when that happens, then myosin is dephosphorylated by myosin phosphatase. Right, so you can see that phosphatase and kinase are antagonistic to each other. And after that phosphatase dephosphorylates myosin, then myosin can no longer form cross bridges, and then smooth muscle relaxes as a result of that. Now, the other interesting thing about smooth muscle is that it can form a state of prolonged binding of actin and myosin that you call a latched state. All right, so smooth muscle can go into basically a tetanus kind of condition where it remains contracted for a long period of time. And you might even think, for instance, maybe even months. Could you think of a smooth muscle that has to remain contracted for maybe a month or two, or three, or four, or five, or six, or seven, or nine, for instance? Yeah, like for instance, like a cervical muscle, right, in a uterus during pregnancy. That muscle has to stay contracted for a long period of time to maintain gestation. Okay. But it uses very little energy because it forms that latched state. So here is, I think, the last exam figure in this chapter. There weren't too many exam figures in this chapter, but this is one of them. All right. And so this is how smooth muscle undergoes excitation, contraction, coupling. And we can see that a muscle can spontaneously, let me show you what this graph is. This is a graph of membrane potential, so this is voltage on the vertical axis versus time. And so we're just looking at one cell. We put an electrode in one cell, and we're looking at the electrical activity or membrane potential. And what can you tell me about the resting membrane potential? Is it flat right here? No, it's not flat. What do we call this little period, this little episode right here in the membrane potential? That is what? Okay, I'm thinking depolarization. Maybe somebody said that. I couldn't quite hear because a lot of people had a lot of good ideas. But I call this depolarization, right? All right, so smooth muscle can spontaneously depolarize. There are a number of different ways that that can happen by maybe some leaky sodium channels, right, that allow sodium to enter the cell, and then those sodium channels close, and maybe some potassium channels open up, and what happens? Repolarization, and then what happens another period of time? Then it spontaneously depolarizes again, and we can see it's a little bit higher amplitude. Now, why don't we see any action potential superimposed on top of this graded potential right here? Because it hasn't met threshold, right? But we'll see maybe the third or the next graded potential does reach threshold, and we see some action potentials that now can propagate over the whole cell, and maybe even if there are gap junctions throughout that whole network of smooth muscle in some organ, like maybe digestive tract or something. Okay. Well, if there are action potentials, right, that will open up voltage-gated calcium channels in the plasma membrane, and then calcium enters the cell, right? And I think I mentioned that already, because for excitation, contraction, coupling, and smooth muscle, where does that calcium come from? From outside the cell, right? So that voltage-gated calcium channel opens up. Calcium then can bind with calmodulin, right? And calmodulin then activates myosin light chain kinase. It does it by taking a phosphate off of it. So again, by adding phosphates or putting phosphates on, that's a usual theme that's used in biology for activating or deactivating various enzymes. By changing a conformation, because it's a big bulky molecule that changes the conformation of this enzyme. All right, so myosin light chain kinase is activated, and what does it do? It bumps into myosin, and in particular the light chain of the big myosin molecule, and phosphorylates it, and when it's phosphorylated, it becomes active. So when myosin light chain is phosphorylated, cross bridges can form, and ATP can be utilized, and myosin and actin will slide over each other as a result. Okay. So, and that's a result of this calcium signal right here. There's also another enzyme that's active pretty much all the time, and that is myosin phosphatase. And myosin phosphatase will dephosphorylate myosin light chain and cause it to go into an inactive or relaxed state. And this happens when, what? When these voltage-gated calcium channels start to close and the calcium ATPases start to pump calcium out of the smooth muscle cell, and then the myosin phosphatase activity takes over and wins out over the myosin light chain kinase reaction, and the muscle starts to relax as a result of that. Okay, so it's interesting to note that this calcium signal interacts with the myosin in smooth muscle, but it interacts with the actin molecule via troponin in cardiac and skeletal muscle. All right, so that's this slide right here. So that's excitation-contraction coupling. A little bit more involved, a little bit longer latent period because more things have to happen inside the cell. So when smooth muscle gets stimulated, it takes longer to contract. It's slower to contract because there are more enzymatic reactions right here. And also, the myosin ATPase is slower as well. So for all of those reasons. And most smooth muscle, okay, if you disrupt them mechanically, if you jab them with something, if you stretch them with something, that causes usually an enhanced graded potential. And just by stretching a smooth muscle, that's going to cause that smooth muscle to contract as a result, because stretching of that muscle will also induce these calcium channels to open up. Okay, so there are two basic kinds of smooth muscle. Well, I tell you what, I think that's about my last slide. All right, so how is it that smooth muscle actually contracts? Let's go back to this slide right here. Okay, and I don't have a picture of contracted smooth muscle, but here we can see the myosin and the actin, and these are going to slide over each other. Well, let's look at this one right here. They're going to slide over each other. And when actin and myosin slide over each other, what happens to the distance between this dense body and this dense body? It gets shorter. And what about between this dense body and this dense body? It gets shorter. So the whole muscle just kind of puckers up, right? It just kind of forms like a little sphere or a little glob. And when it relaxes, it goes back to what that elongated shape. So that's how a smooth muscle cell contracts compared to just longitudinal shortening of a myofibril in skeletal muscle. And it's just these little surface dense bodies that get closer together when a smooth muscle contracts. Well, we got two different kinds of smooth muscle. There's something called single unit, and then there's multi-unit smooth muscle. Single unit smooth muscle is spontaneously active. We say it's myogenic. It has little sodium leak channels that allow sodium to leak into the cell. And when sodium leaks into the cell, it does what? It depolarizes. And if it depolarizes to threshold, then that muscle is going to contract. Right? And as a matter of fact, some are pacemaker cells. That means that some cells have very leaky sodium channels. So they reach threshold compared to neighboring cells. But these kinds of muscles have gap junctions. So if a pacemaker cell depolarizes, what happens to all the cells in the neighborhood?
They get excited.
They depolarize as well because of those gap junctions. So there could be one cell, for instance, in the small intestine that depolarizes that's going to cause that whole segment of the intestine to contract and, for instance, move material through your digestive tract. All right, so we call this single unit because when one cell depolarizes, because of that gap junction, they all depolarize. It acts as a single unit. Okay, multi-unit requires nerve stimulation by the autonomic nervous system. So single unit does not, right, but multi-unit does. And don't forget, how many divisions are there in the autonomic nervous system? There are two, right? So there's parasympathetic and sympathetic, and they're antagonistic to each other. So the neurotransmitter released along a series of synapses of these autonomic neurons that we call varicosities. And we call these synapses in Poisson. And maybe I showed you this slide before. So here we see, for instance, multi-unit smooth muscle. And for instance, this might be a sympathetic neuron. This might be a parasympathetic neuron right here. Multi-unit smooth muscle, we say multi-unit because there are no gap junctions. And you know this is an autonomic neuron because where do you have synaptic vesicles? Not just at the axon terminus, way out over here someplace, but where? Along the whole extent of the axon. And so that's either going to excite or inhibit these cells from contracting, depending on which nervous system is stimulated. But this right here is single unit smooth muscle because you can see what? Gap junctions between the cells. And even though smooth muscle cells here aren't branched because of the arrangement of these gap junctions, right? If this superficial smooth muscle cell depolarizes because of the nature of these gap junctions, right? It can move laterally as well as throughout the whole depth of that particular tissue. Okay, so that's kind of the big difference between skeletal muscle, smooth muscle, and cardiac muscle. And you have a pretty good table in your book that kind of is a nice synopsis for that. And I put that on the study guide for you to review. Okay? Okay, so that's pretty much it for muscle. So all muscles do have actin and myosin. The arrangement is a little bit different. So what kind of muscles have sarcomeres? Skeletal muscle and? And cardiac muscle, which doesn't have a sarcomere. Smooth. Now what does, instead of a Z disc, what does smooth muscle have? Okay, it has those dense bodies, the dense bodies, right? So actin has to anchor into some part of the cell. In skeletal and cardiac muscle, actin anchors into the Z discs, but in smooth muscle, the actin anchors itself into the dense bodies, and then the dense bodies get pulled closer together. All right, so that's it for muscle. Okay. All right, so let's move on to heart and blood and circulation. All right, so some of these things we're going to go over. I'll talk a little bit about blood. Sometimes in anatomy, we don't talk a lot about blood, like in transfusion reactions and coagulation and things like that. But for instance, pulmonary and systemic circulations, you got to review that in anatomy from your anatomy book. Heart valves, you should know the names of. And let's see, we'll cover cardiac cycle, electrical activity of the heart in here. And then structure of blood vessels, you should probably pretty much know already from anatomy as well. But I included some slides. All right, so what are some of the functions of blood? What kind of tissue is blood? It's connective tissue because it connects all the different parts of your body, but it's kind of a strange connective tissue because why? Because bone is a kind of connective tissue, right? Dense regular tissue is connective tissue. But why is blood, why do I think blood is kind of a strange connective tissue? Because it's fluid. Yeah, it's a fluid. So it flows through all the different parts of your body. So it can be used for transporting materials like nutrients that you need, oxygen, right? Glucose, various enzymes that we're going to look at, and hormones. That's how hormones are distributed throughout your body. But not only does it transport stuff to tissues, it transports stuff that we don't need away from tissues so that we can excrete it or somehow get rid of it from our bodies, like carbon dioxide and other kinds of waste products, like urea. Not only is it important for transporting molecules, but it's important for transporting heat. So for heat transfer, when you use a muscle, it heats up, and you can go into hyperthermia, and blood can go and absorb that heat and transport the heat to the surface of your body where you can radiate it out of yourself and maintain body temperature. So for heat transport, that's very important for maintaining temperature homeostasis. Blood is also important for maintaining fluid balance in your body and electrolyte balance. And another very important electrolyte is, where do I have the cursor right here? The hydrogen ion, right? That's an electrolyte, but it also determines the reactivity of many chemical reactions. And the blood also plays an important protection role because it fights disease, it fights microorganisms, foreign substances, because there are immune cells in the blood and even tumors. And we probably all had various tumors in our body, but our immune system recognized those tumors before they became any kind of important clinical object or produced any kind of disease, and those tumors were destroyed by our immune system. So that's actively happening all the time. All right, and another important function of blood is that since it's a fluid, if you put a hole in a blood vessel, what happens to it? Depending on that blood vessel, it's going to ooze out, or if it's a high-pressure vessel like an artery, it's actually going to come squirting out of your body, right? And so another important function of the circulatory system is that it prevents blood loss when a blood vessel is damaged. So there has to be some kind of mechanism to prevent blood loss. All right, so what are some components of the circulatory system? They include the cardiovascular system. So that's kind of a loaded term because that means the heart as well as blood vessels. But it also includes the lymphatic system. And maybe you learned a little bit about the lymphatic system in anatomy, maybe not, okay? But so I'll mention a little bit about it right here. So the heart pumps blood through the vascular system. Blood vessels carry blood from the heart to cells. So what kind of vessel carries blood away from the heart? An artery. Yep, okay. So you got to know the definition of an artery and a vein. And an artery always carries blood away from the heart. And a vein always carries blood to the heart. And you should know the names of some arteries that carry oxygenated blood and the names of some arteries that carry deoxygenated blood as well, right? So the definition of an artery is just the direction of blood flow, not what the blood is carrying. Can anybody give me an example of an artery that is carrying deoxygenated blood? Yeah, the pulmonary trunk, for instance. And an artery that carries oxygenated blood would be? The aorta. Okay, I want an artery, so you can't say pulmonary vein, but you're right, pulmonary vein is carrying oxygenated blood. But give me the name of an artery carrying blood away from the heart that is oxygenated. Oh, yeah, the aorta, for sure. Yeah, the aorta. Yeah, which is like the counterpart to the pulmonary artery, but it's on the other side of the heart. All right, so blood vessels include arteries, arterioles, capillaries, venules, and veins, so make sure you know the definition for these things right here. All right, and I want to distinguish that from the lymphatic system. The lymphatic system picks up stuff that is very much like plasma, bless you, all right, which is tissue fluid. And that fluid came from the vascular system, and it surrounds all the cells of your body. But not all of that fluid can be picked up by a capillary, and it can't stay in your body because you would swell up, right? You'd just turn into a big water balloon. So that fluid definitely has to be returned to the vascular system, and it's returned via the lymphatic system. So there are lymphatic vessels that act like another venous blood vessel, except it doesn't carry blood, it just carries tissue fluid back toward the heart so that that fluid can rejoin your circulatory system so that you don't dehydrate and that you don't swell up. Okay, and when somebody swells up, we call that edema, okay, in some part of your body. So the lymphatic system protects that edema from forming, okay? And then also, as that fluid, which we call lymph, flows back to the heart, it has to pass through a lymph node, and a lymph node is part of the immune system, and lymph nodes are always sampling material that's in lymph to see if it contains any bacteria, viruses, or tumor cells, or whatever. And then hopefully that lymph node can figure out a way how to kill those cells that don't belong there as part of your immune response. Okay, so those are the three parts of the cardiovascular system, including the lymphatic system. All right, so let's just strictly talk about blood. We're not going to talk about lymph, which is in lymphatic vessels, but just blood. All right, so if someone were to draw blood from you out of a vein in your arm, we would call that whole blood. And what would it look like?
Red.
It would be red, very, very dark red. Okay. But we can break whole blood down into a number of different compartments and then some components within those compartments. All right. So there is a fluid part of blood that we call plasma. And then there are what we call formed elements in blood, and that's the cellular part of blood. So blood is just more than fluid. It is composed of lots of different kinds of cells. All right, so let's just think about plasma, the fluid part. Most of that is water and then stuff that's dissolved in water. And most of everything else that's dissolved in plasma are proteins. Proteins can dissolve in water very nicely. We have albumins, globulins, and clotting factors. These clotting factors are going to be very important for preventing blood loss when a blood vessel gets damaged. These globulins, we've kind of talked about these before. For instance, if there is a hydrophobic molecule, like maybe, T4, which is hydrophobic, won't dissolve in plasma. It can bind to a globulin, and then it will be soluble in blood and can be transported. All right. Albumins are proteins that are made by your liver to help maintain water balance. And this kind of goes way, way back. All right, so if we have one compartment over here and another compartment over here, and we have a lot of albumins, all right, so I'm just going to abbreviate this, albumin, 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 and maybe just a couple sodiums over here. All right, and you got water over here, and you got some water over here. Which way is water going to osmose across this membrane? Is it going to go from left to right or right to left? It's going to go from left to right, right, because this is very, very concentrated in solute, this albumin. So albumins that are made by the liver help draw water out of tissue spaces back into a blood vessel or back into a capillary. All right, so albumins help return tissue fluid back into a capillary, and the remaining fluid that isn't drawn back into a capillary by these albumins right here get picked up by the lymphatic system, and then that's carried back to the heart, so you don't lose that, you don't become dehydrated. Okay, so I said that the liver is responsible for producing those albumins. So if the liver doesn't produce these albumins, what happens to tissue fluid? What happens to a person? The tissue fluid expands because it isn't drawn back into the blood, that produces edema, and that happens with different kinds of liver diseases, okay, if it's affecting albumin production. All right, so what else do we have in plasma? Well, ions, like give me an ion. What's your favorite ion? Hydrogen ion, yeah, okay, pH, sodium, potassium, chloride, all those, magnesium, various nutrients. What kind of nutrients dissolve in plasma easily? Glucose, perfect example. Some gases like carbon dioxide can easily dissolve in plasma. Oxygen doesn't like to very much, right? Oxygen is not very soluble in plasma, and we're going to see that you still have to transport oxygen in your blood, so there's got to be some other mechanism. It just can't dissolve in plasma. And then, of course, waste products are transported by plasma pretty easily, like urea, for instance. And then we have another term right here, which we call serum. And serum is related to plasma. Serum is everything that we normally find in plasma except for these proteins that are clotting factors. All right, so if we take plasma and subtract out clotting factors, we're left over with serum. All right, so serum contains globulins to fight infections, for instance, and so there might be a time when we have to give somebody a serum that has an antibody to a particular venom. All right, and so we call that an anti-venom or an anti-serum, but it's basically what? Just like plasma that you have in your body, it can fight infections or various venoms, but when we inject it into somebody, it's not going to cause any clotting abnormalities. All right, so it can't clot on its own. So that's plasma. These formed elements right here, we really mean cells. And we got three major classes of formed elements. These are all cellular in nature. So when you think of a cell, what separates a cell from the outside world? The plasma membrane. So all of these things have plasma membranes, but not all of them have organelles or even a nucleus, which is kind of strange. Red blood cells, most of formed elements, 95% are red blood cells. These don't have a nucleus. As a matter of fact, do they have any organelles at all? They might not have any organelles. They can't make ATP, only through glycolysis. All right, so they have very limited function. Another name for a red blood cell is an erythrocyte, so you could tell me what erythro means. I don't know if you speak that language. I didn't even know what language it is, but you should be able to tell me what it is. It means red, right? Erythro is red. This is a red blood cell. And the reason why there are no organelles inside red blood cells is because they're loaded completely with a chemical called hemoglobin, and that hemoglobin molecule can carry four oxygen molecules. Oxygen can't dissolve in plasma, but red blood cells do carry oxygen to the tissues. All right, so that's the job of a red blood cell. You have a lot of white blood cells, but only about 1% of the formed elements are made up of white blood cells. These are nucleated, and we call these leukocytes. These generally are important for immune response, fight infections. And guess what leuko means? Right, that's right. It means white. So for instance, what's the symbol of the United States? The animal symbol. It's probably on a dollar bill. What kind of eagle?
Bald eagle.
What color is his head?
White.
It's white. He's not really bald. He just has a bunch of white feathers and a white... I think I saw one over the break, which is pretty cool. It's kind of rare around here. Guess what its scientific name is? Leuko something. Yeah, leuko bird. Leuko something. The scientific name is leukocephalus. Cephalus means what? Toward the head. Leuko is white, right? So don't forget leukocyte is a white cell. And then, 5% of formed elements are platelets. Another name is a thrombocyte. These things are important for, they work with clotting factors to prevent blood loss. Okay, so these are all formed elements or cell. Now platelets don't have, these are cell fragments, they don't have organelles, there's no nucleus in them, and they're kind of short-lived as well compared to red blood cells. White blood cells have a little bit longer life because they can respond to things in their environment because they have a nucleus that can reinitiate protein synthesis, for instance. Okay. All right, so something you should know is hematocrit. And the definition of hematocrit is just the percentage of red blood cells in whole blood. Because if we think of one of the major functions of blood is to transport oxygen, that's done by red blood cells. So we want to know how many red blood cells are in whole blood to know about our oxygen carrying capacity of the blood. All right, and so it's just a percentage of red blood cells in whole blood. And remember, whole blood is made, what are the two components in whole blood? It is plasma and formed elements, okay? But the hematocrit is not formed elements, it's just red blood cells. So if we take whole blood out of somebody and put it in a test tube and let it sit overnight, we can see that all the formed elements are heavier than plasma and they settle down to the bottom. But if you don't want to wait overnight, how can you do it in like 30 seconds? Yeah, you can put it in a centrifuge and spin it down, so all the heavy things go to the bottom of the test tube. All right, so you could probably tell me what the hematocrit of this sample is, because 100% is what? From the top here all the way down to the bottom, and 50% is maybe right about here someplace. All right, so what about hematocrit? What's the percentage of red blood cells? Is it 50%? It's actually a little bit less. Just if you eyeball that, you can see it's a little bit less, maybe 40%, 45%, somewhere in there. All right, so that would be a crude guess. We could measure it if we had a graduated cylinder. All right, but that would be the hematocrit. It would be about 45% compared to the whole volume, the whole volume that you get from whole blood. And if you look at this part over here, you see what the red blood cells, you see some of these white blood cells and platelets. This buffy coat right here are formed elements, but these are a little bit lighter. It's made up of platelets and white blood cells, and usually that's pretty negligible when you're calculating hematocrit, right? So it's not too critical. So here's a question that you could work out tonight. For instance, to make sure you understand what hematocrit is and know how to use your calculator. So for instance, if you have an 80 ml sample of whole blood, that means somebody takes out any 80 ml out of a blood vessel, okay, from a normal individual, all right, and if it contained 30 ml of erythrocytes and 0.72 milliliters of these leukocytes and 4 milliliters of thrombocytes, right, after centrifuging, so you spun it down like that and got a really nice clean sample like that, is a sample from a man or a woman? All right, so would you be able to calculate that? I don't want to calculate it right now, but work on it. If you have a question, then talk to your lab instructor or maybe see me sometimes. But you should be able to answer that question, because what else do you see? You see the normal range for hematocrit in males and females right here. Okay? So Probably some of you can do that in your mind. I probably would like to use a calculator. All right, so to get started, what would you use? You would use red blood cells, right? The volume of red blood cells, right? Because it's the percent of red blood cells in whole blood. Okay. Right, so plasma proteins. I think I talked about this already. Proteins, basically three kinds, the albumin, the globulins, and clotting factors. Ah, okay. Well, that's why I have this slide right here, because I want to go over clotting factors one more time. One important clotting factor is fibrinogen. Okay? And this is important because I'm not sure we've gone over nomenclature yet, but whenever you see a term with an O-gen on the end of it, that means something. Does anybody know what that means? Have I talked about it already in here? Okay. It means that it is inactive. It's not ready to do its job because it's inactive, right? Like a pre-hormone or a pro-hormone. If there's a pro at the beginning of a word, that means it's inactive and it can be converted into an active form. Another similar kind of nomenclature, if there is O-gen at the end of the word, that also means that this particular molecule is inactive, but it can be converted into an active form in just a split second, which is really good. So fibrinogen can be converted in just a split second to fibrin, and fibrin is going to prevent blood loss. All right. So for instance, if your body needed to build a lot of fibrin to stop a hemorrhage that was happening due to damage to a large blood vessel, you probably wouldn't have 4 or 5 hours or 12 hours to wait around for cells to produce enough fibrin to form a clot in that blood vessel. So what is happening is that the liver is constantly producing fibrinogen, right, so that you have high levels in your circulatory system that can be converted in just a moment's notice to stop bleeding. Right, so that's the beauty of having a molecule like in reserve ready to go to work. Right, so we're going to take a look at fibrinogen. Okay, and then don't forget, serum is what? Is the fluid part, is plasma, minus all of these different clotting factors. But it has globulins and albumin and everything else in it. So osmotically, it's balanced. It just doesn't have clotting factors in it. Okay, so the formed elements, erythrocytes, leukocytes, and thrombocytes. Red blood cells, like these guys over here, are biconcave. They have a little dimple in them. The shape provides for increased surface area for diffusion. So oxygen can dissolve or diffuse across the membrane rapidly. All right, and the shape also means that they can squish down. They can actually deform to get through very, very small capillaries as they go through your cardiovascular system. All right, they don't have a nucleus, no mitochondria. They're loaded with about 280 million hemoglobin molecules each. And each hemoglobin can carry 4 oxygen molecules and deliver it to tissues, where the tissue mitochondria then can utilize that oxygen to make ATP. And guess how many red blood cells are made every day in your body? Wow, it looks like our national debt, 300 billion. Okay, so this number was so huge that nobody ever had any slightest idea how big that is. That's a huge number. We're sort of getting a little bit familiar with it, but again, nobody has any idea of how big a billion is, right? But at least we're throwing those terms around now in terms of bailouts and things like that. Okay, that's a huge, huge number. All right, so let's just talk about leukocytes for a second. I'll go back to erythrocytes. All right, they do have a nucleus, they have mitochondria, and they can move around your body by amoeboid motion that we call diapedesis. They can squeeze through the capillary wall. So here we see a white blood cell that's actually crawling out of a blood vessel, out of a capillary, and it can wander around in this tissue space. And depending on what kind of leukocyte it is, it will perform different kinds of functions. It might be a search and destroy function, or it might produce inflammation. It might actually increase the leakiness of this capillary so that more fluid leaks out, more white blood cells will go to a site of infection, for instance. Well, there are some white blood cells that have these granules in them, and we call those granular leukocytes. They help detoxify foreign substances, and they can also release heparin. Okay, what does heparin do? Anybody know what does? It's an anticoagulant that just preserves the patency of this blood vessel right here so that blood doesn't clot, all right, and block this blood vessel off. under normal circumstances. All right, so here are the three kinds of granular leukocytes: eosinophils, basophils, and neutrophils. All right, neutrophils really do fight foreign invaders. All right, but the eosinophils and basophils are more involved with releasing heparin and promoting inflammation. So for instance, if this blood vessel becomes dilated and starts to leak, what is that area in your body going to look like? Yeah, it's going to look swollen, and it's going to look red as a result of that as well. So for instance, if you have allergies and you're red, your eyes turn kind of red, well, it's these capillaries around the eyes that are becoming a little bit leaky, and there's a little bit more blood in that area, and it kind of looks a little bit reddish. Okay, the egg granular leukocytes are phagocytic in nature, and they produce antibodies. The monocytes are the phagocytes. All right, when a monocyte leaves the cardiovascular system via diapedesis and starts wandering around even inside your lungs looking for things that you inhale, like bacteria, fungus, or whatever, then it becomes a macrophage because it's a big cell. Right, so macrophages are monocytes that have left the circulatory system. All right, these lymphocytes are always in the circulatory system, and they're responsible for producing antibodies that help you fight infection. Okay. All right, platelets. They're very, very small. You can hardly see them with a light microscope. They lack a nucleus as well. They are amoeboid. All right, they come from megakaryocytes in bone marrow, and platelets form most of the mass of a blood clot when a blood vessel is damaged. Platelets release serotonin, which causes vasoconstriction. When a blood vessel vasoconstricts, can you see that when a vessel vasoconstricts, that reduces blood flow through that blood vessel, that helps prevent blood loss. Right, that's like almost tying a ligature around a blood vessel. That's due to serotonin. And platelets also release growth factors to maintain blood vessels, and they only live for about 9 days. Right? So because why? They don't have a nucleus. They can't respond to any kind of challenge. So they have a very short lifespan. Okay, hematopoiesis is an important term that you should be aware of. And hematopoiesis is just the formation of blood cells from precursor cells that we call stem cells, and this happens in bone marrow. And in particular, maybe you can remember there's two kinds of bone marrow. There's yellow and red, and this is going to be in red bone marrow producing blood cells. And so red bone marrow is what we call myeloid tissue. Okay, and white blood cells are produced in lymphoid tissue. Marrow produces about 500 billion blood cells a day. And in the fetus, that doesn't have a lot of red bone marrow, that occurs in the liver. All right, so let's break down hematopoiesis into two terms. One is erythropoiesis, so that means that's the formation of red blood cells, right? And leukopoiesis is the formation of white blood cells, and it's controlled by a couple different mechanisms. Erythropoiesis is controlled by a hormone, erythropoietin, and that primarily comes from the kidney, and the kidney can monitor oxygen concentration in the blood, and when oxygen concentration decreases, the kidney then secretes erythropoietin, which then goes to red bone marrow, stimulates red blood cell production, which feeds back negatively. All right, that increases oxygen concentration in the blood, and then the kidney stops the secretion of erythropoietin. So it's a nice negative feedback control mechanism. All right, and today we don't really give patients erythropoietin. We give them a genetically engineered form of that drug, which is called EPO. So the gene that is used to make erythropoietin in humans was isolated, and then that gene was used to transform bacteria. It was inserted into the genome of bacteria so that bacteria knows how to make erythropoietin. And then all day long, those bacteria and test tubes make erythropoietin, and then somebody just walks by with a pipette, kind of crudely speaking, and takes it and uses it. All right, so that's a lot better than having to grind up kidneys from cadavers and isolating erythropoietin, right, to be used in a hospital. A lot cheaper as well. Leukopoiesis, which stimulates formation of white blood cells, is by a variety of cytokines, and so I'm not going to mention that. All right, but that's a different kind of process. You should be really more familiar with erythropoietin. All right, so 300 billion red blood cells a day is quite a bit. If we kind of figure out how many per second red blood cells a person has to make, it's somewhere between 2 and 3 million red blood cells every second. All right, and if your body can't make 2 to 3 million every second, what happens to that person? What do they become? They become anemic. That's right. So that's a very important process. So you can see the different kinds of cells. This is not an exam figure. All right, but I think you should be amazed at how metabolic red bone marrow is throughout your whole body, how important it is to be active producing those 2 to 3 million red blood cells every second. And that's because these red blood cells don't have a nucleus. So again, they have a very limited lifespan of only about 120 days. These old red blood cells that can no longer transport oxygen are removed from blood vessels by the spleen. And the liver, primarily the spleen, and maybe a little bit by the bone marrow. Okay, and then the components, namely hemoglobin, can be broken down to resynthesize hemoglobin again. And there's one important element in hemoglobin that is iron that can be also recycled by the liver and put back into hemoglobin and then put back into newly synthesized red blood cells. So iron is certainly recycled as well. Okay, so I don't have the breakdown of hemoglobin for you. I don't think you have a question at the end of the chapter. If you have an interest in that and knowing something about jaundice, I can maybe see me after class. Okay, so here is erythropoiesis, which is what? The production of red blood cells. So here you have the kidney that can monitor a blood oxygen concentration. When it decreases, the kidney releases erythropoietin, that is, goes into the blood. And what is, how would you classify that molecule when it gets into the blood? Is that an enzyme or what? It's a hormone, yeah, because it's secreted by the kidney, goes into the blood, and then it's carried by the blood to red bone marrow. So there it's going to bind to receptors, and that's going to stimulate the production of red blood cells. And as the number of red blood cell increases, what happens to oxygen concentration in the blood? It goes up, okay, and then that feeds back negatively to the kidney, and the kidney then reduces the amount of erythropoietin that it is secreted. So here's a nice negative feedback mechanism. So erythropoietin is not an enzyme, but it's a hormone from the kidney. Okay. Okay, let's talk about blood groups. And transfusion reactions. Okay, and we're going to talk about the ABO system. And there are numerous blood group systems, all right, but this is, I think, the first one that was worked out. And this is due to antigens that are present on the surface of red blood cells. And there are two major kinds of antigens. So antigens we find on the surface of a red blood cell. That's a key part to remember. All right, so remember that the, how do you think of a plasma membrane? What is phospholipid bilayer, right? That's a basic way that you can think of a plasma membrane. What's another little bit more complicated, a little bit more accurate way to think of a plasma membrane? A model in your mind, which would be the fluid mosaic model. So you can put what, receptors, channels, and one of the other things that we talked about being put into a plasma membrane were antigens, right? So antigens are going to be sticking on the out from the plasma membrane into the extracellular side of the plasma membrane. So they're going to be sticking out, and these things are going to be identifiers of this particular cell. So somebody found one, and guess what they call the first one? Yeah. All right, so here is, an A might be for antigen, okay, maybe, but it's probably the first one that they noticed. All right, and this is a nice red blood cell right here. Okay, I don't know why I used the black marker, but I should have used the red marker. Okay, so what blood type is this person right here? Okay, so a person that has an A antigen on the surface of red blood cells is blood type A. Okay, and then there people are investigating and they find a different kind of antigen. Guess what they call that? B antigen. And it's located in the same place. Where is that? Right on the surface of the red blood cell. And they investigate a little bit more, and guess what do they find? They find a red blood cell that doesn't have any antigens on it. So what do you call that? You could call it C, but it doesn't really make a lot of sense. And then somebody had a good idea, and they did what? They go, oh. All right? And so we call this blood type O, and what O, I think, really stands for is zero. Right? Blood type O doesn't have any antigens. Okay. All right. But what this blood group system is an interaction between antigens and antibodies. Okay? All right. So a person with blood type A makes an antibody. Now, what kind of antibody do you think this person is going to make? Is it going to make an antibody to this A antigen? What would happen? Right? That means that this antibody, and an antibody kind of looks like a little person with two arms, with two hands, and the hands can grab onto antigens. And the way that an antibody can grab onto an antigen is by the shape of the molecule, just like a ligand and a receptor, for instance. So the shape of the antibody has to match up with the shape of the antigen. All right? But so this antibody can grab one antigen, and then the other hand can grab another red blood cell. And then another antibody can grab another red blood cell. So red blood cells can clump together. That's what we call a transfusion reaction. When thousands or millions of red blood cells all get clumped together, they're bound up with these antibodies. So a person with blood type A has got, right, that kind of, okay, like receptor site on the antibody. So what is it going to bind? This is antibody B, or sometimes we just say anti-B, because what's going to fit in here? It's going to be the shape of this B antigen. All right, so now you got to remember that these antigens really don't have a shape like an A or a B, right? We're just using that as an example, right? But it's got a particular shape. So somebody with blood type A makes these anti-B antibodies automatically. So if you transfuse somebody that's blood type A with somebody that has B blood, what's going to happen? It's going to form a transfusion reaction. All right, these things are going to clump together. Oh, there's another kind of blood too. What happens if somebody has these kinds of antigens? What blood type is that? That's type AB. That's possible as well. Right? We don't have time to get into the genetics of this, but those are basically the four blood types in the ABO system. You've got A, B, AB, and then O right here. Okay. All right, so a person with blood type A makes anti-B. A person with blood type B makes what kind of antibody? Anti-A, right? Anti-A. And a person with blood type AB, what kind of antibody do they make? You know, they can't make any, because if there was anti-A or anti-B, it would clump their blood, right? It would cause, and I'll tell you what that term is called in a second. So this person would be what? No antibodies right here. And what about somebody with blood type O? They can make both anti-A and anti-B, and it won't matter. Right? It will protect them from foreign cells. Right? So blood type O has both anti-A and anti-B. Right? So that's kind of what this shows you right here. All right, so here's a nice table that shows what does the A antigen look like in this illustration? Sort of looks like an A, but it's a triangle, right? And then B kind of looks like a square over here. Here is an antibody, and look at the receptor region right here. You can see that it would bind with the B antigen, so this is anti-B. Anti-B you find in somebody with blood type A, right? And if we mix antibody B with B blood, you can see that they bind together, and then another antibody can bind with another one and another one and another one. And when blood clumps together like that, we call that agglutination. All right, and the end result of agglutination is that these cells right here are going to hemolyze, which means what? They're going to burst. But if they're all clumped together, they're not going to flow through your circulatory system. They're going to hemolyze. And, of course, that's a very fatal kind of situation, right, when that happens to your blood. All right, so we always frown upon having transfusion reactions in hospitals. Okay, so type B blood has antibodies to type A red blood cells, but not to type B. Type AB blood doesn't have antibodies to either A or B. And type O has antibodies to both A and B. Okay, and if you mix these things inappropriately, you get agglutination. So what kind of reaction is agglutination? It's an?
Like clotting.
It's sort of like clotting. I want you to have a really clear idea of that by the time we're done with this lecture. But agglutination is a reaction between an, what is this right here? An antigen and an antibody. So agglutination is an antibody-antigen reaction that causes clumping together, which is going to destroy those red blood cells. Okay. All right, and so here sort of what it looks like. So here we just have some blood. And so if you have blood type A and put anti-B in it, we don't get a transfusion reaction. But if we have blood type A and put anti-A in there, guess what happens to it? It just crystallizes. It precipitates out, right, because the antibodies are just grabbing all the antigens and basically gluing all those red blood cells together. And again, if we have blood type B and we put anti-B in it, again, that causes that precipitation, but not anti-A. And if we have blood type AB, and if we put either anti-B or anti-A, it's going to cause, what is that process called?
Agglutination.
And agglutination is what kind of process? Antibody-antigen reaction, right? Which is a totally different thing than blood clotting. Okay, blood type O is what we call a universal donor because it lacks the A and B antigens. All right, so for instance, if a donor has anti-B and we give them blood type O, that really doesn't matter because that anti-B doesn't have any antigens to agglutinate on. Right, so that's not going to cause a transfusion reaction. Blood type AB is what we call the universal recipient because this type AB blood doesn't make anti-A or anti-B antibodies. So when we transfuse that into somebody, again, that won't cause a transfusion reaction. All right. We kind of teach this stuff right here, but in real life, would this ever happen? Would you ever want to transfuse somebody with type O blood if they didn't cross-match properly, for instance, in a hospital? No, that would never happen, right? So if you got into a car accident and you were hemorrhaging and you walked into emergency room and said, I need some blood right away. I know what my blood type is. I'm blood type AB. Give me some blood type AB right away because I've been hemorrhaging. So are people going to drop what they're doing and give you blood type that you're asking for? Absolutely not, right? Because if you're wrong, what's going to happen? Well, you're going to die, right? Plus, there's more than just the ABO system, right? There are other things that are used for cross-matching that people have to be very particular about as well.
What's the positive and negative?
Yeah, I think I got a couple slides on that. A and B positive, yeah. I mean, positive or negative. That might even be the next slide. That is the next slide, yes. Both of them.
So when you donate it to like to blood type A, the antibody doesn't affect the blood?
Okay. It gets diluted out. But in real life, would anybody ever really do that? Only in very rare circumstances, right? So if you're in some part of the world that doesn't have a blood bank, or maybe if you're on a battlefield someplace and somebody's hemorrhaging and you just so happen to have, you know, some units of blood that you can save somebody's life for a short period of time, but typically in this situation, you would never transfuse somebody like that. Yeah, it would work temporarily, yeah. Okay. Okay, so this Rh factor, okay, and Rh factor, again, is an antibody-antigen kind of reaction, right? But it's a different system. It's not ABO. It was first worked out with an experimental model, and that model was a rhesus monkey. Okay, so it's a little tiny monkey. And so the Rh comes from rhesus, that term. And this blood group system is a little bit simpler because there's only one. Right? And so if I was going to draw that, okay, so let's say, what's the blood type of this person? You would say A. And this one is B. All right? Rh is another kind of system. So if this person was like this, what would be the blood type in terms of the ABO and Rh factor? This person would be blood type A, and since it has the Rh antigen, it would be plus. Okay? If the person didn't have the Rh factor antigen on the surface of the red blood cell, this person's blood type would be A negative. All right, so just really simple, just like that. All right, so maybe on the test I will give you a cell that looks like this, and you got to tell me what the blood type is in terms of the ABO system as well as the Rh factor. So for instance, this right here, what's the blood type of this person? O what? O negative, because there's no A, there's no B, and there's also no Rh. So that's O negative. What'd be this person? AB negative. And if it was going to be positive, there'd have to be what? Rh on here. Then that would be AB positive. Right? So is that sort of making sense? So don't forget, the antigen is always on the surface of the red blood cell. Antibodies are in the plasma. That's one of the plasma proteins. Yeah. Actually, we don't like to do that. Okay. You can do it one time, because in the ABO system, this person automatically makes anti-B. Okay. But for instance, if you have this person, I tell you what, I'll stay with the same one right here, makes anti-B, but this person does not automatically make anti-Rh. That doesn't automatically happen. In order for you to make anti-Rh, you have to be sensitized to it. You have to be exposed to that antigen sometime in your life. Maybe you've been given a transfusion reaction or something. After the first exposure to the Rh antigen from somewhere, your body then will start to make anti-Rh, so you can't ever get transfused again. All right, so that is sort of interesting because there's a condition that's called erythroblastosis fetalis, or hemolytic disease of the newborn. What does agglutination cause? It causes hemolysis, right? Okay. So hemolytic disease of the newborn is a special kind of circumstance where you have one person inside of another person. When does that happen? Like during gestation.
Yeah.
During gestation, for instance. All right, so if you have a mom, so let's see, we got mom. Where's mom? Here's mom. Okay, and let's say mom is Rh negative. And then here you got a baby, and baby is Rh positive. So there is what? There's a mismatch in antigens right here. All right, so here's mom. And maybe this is the second or third pregnancy, so the mom might have been already subjected to this antigen, Rh positive. So what is the mom making? The mom is making anti-Rh. All right, so the antigen is in the plasma. And how did this baby get to be Rh positive if mom is Rh negative? Well, okay, well, the baby right here is Rh positive because maybe the dad. Well, the dad has to be Rh positive. So the baby just has a 50-50 chance of being Rh positive or Rh negative. All right, so it just so happens by a flip of the coin that the baby is Rh positive. Mom is making anti-Rh, and this antibody can go across the placenta and attack the baby's red blood cells when that happens, right? And that destroys those red blood cells, releases a lot of hemoglobin into the blood, that puts a huge burden on the liver, can't detoxify all that hemoglobin, and so the baby is born jaundiced because one of the breakdown products of hemoglobin is bilirubin. And that's also a neurotoxin for developing fetuses.
Is that called stillbirth?
Usually not, but other kinds of problems like mental retardation and things like that. I don't think it's necessarily always fatal, but usually we know way ahead of time, because even way back when, before you got married, what did you always have to get?
Blood
test to find out if there was that mismatch that would happen if the mom is negative and the dad is positive. But now we know so much about the disease, it can be prevented so easily, right, at least in this country, that it's not really a significant worry for us. Okay? So that's the Rh thing. So just always remember that what transfusion reactions are, antibody antigen reaction, we call that agglutination. And you might wonder, how come we don't have like a transfusion reaction if there's a mismatch between the ABO system during gestation, only the Rh factor? And that's because these antibodies, these anti-Rh, are really small. They go across the placenta, but the antibodies for the ABO system are too big. They don't go across the placenta, so they can't attack the fetus. Okay, so typically ABO is not clinically significant.
So blood type is hereditary, right?
Blood type is hereditary. Pretty straightforward and easy genetics. That's why it's common for babies to be born with jaundice. But anytime you either destroy red blood cells or you destroy the liver, somebody could be born with jaundice. So you kind of have to know why somebody is jaundiced. Yeah, it has to do with bilirubin, and light helps detoxify bilirubin. Yeah. Yeah. So. Billy lights. That's interesting. I never heard that term, but I
that's actual name.
Okay, but I think everybody would understand what you're talking about. That would help reduce the level of bilirubin, and then that would help prevent mental retardation. That would help somebody's nervous system develop normally. Thank you so much. Yeah. Well, as soon as the baby's born, okay, then the baby's blood is no longer being attacked by the mom's antibodies. So they might be able to recover pretty quickly after that. Yeah.